WSHU's Join the Conversation series is sponsored by IKEA New Haven and the Wyand Cimbeli Group.
I am now very excited and very pleased to present Roxanne Cody, who is the founder of RJ Julia Booksellers and New York Times best-selling author of The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Sons, Khaled Husseini.
Good evening. My name is Roxanne Cody. I guess you figured out which one of us is which. Khaled Husseini was born in Kabul in 1965 and has lived in Iran, Paris, and the United States since he was 15. His two astonishing previous novels, The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Sons, have combined spent almost 3 years on bestseller lists and have sold 38 million copies. And there's a good reason for this. Great stories envelop you. They attach you to characters. They immerse you in another world. They whisper in your ear. And you hear a story you never want to end. Mr. Husseini, Dr. Husseini, has again captured us, held us in his wise and caring arms. As even Michiko Kakutani of the New York Times had to admit, he has spun his characters' lives into a deeply affecting choral work that is a testament to both his intimate knowledge of their inner lives and to his power as a storyteller. Khaled, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you.
So we'll start with a pretty basic question.
Okay.
What inspired you to write your Mountains and the Mountains Echoed?
Well, it had been a number of years since I put out a book, so I said I better start
writing. You better get going.
Yeah. I began this probably in November of 2009, and I'd been sort of looking for something to write. And I had started one or two writing projects in the intervening time since the release of my second novel. And they just kind of lost steam and didn't really get attached to them. And then suddenly one day I just kind of was kind of struck by this image. It just seemed to come out of nowhere. It was about this guy, and he was walking across a desert, and he was pulling a red little wagon behind him. And inside the wagon was a little girl. And about 10 paces behind them was a boy, and they were heading somewhere. And I became absolutely possessed by this image, and I had to find out what this was. And I kind of began toying with it, and I realized that, well, I think the little girl and the boy are brother and sister. They're siblings, and they absolutely love each other. And they're going to Kabul, where something is going to happen that is going to rupture their very tender and loving relationship. And that separation of the siblings is then just going to have some kind of effect on the lives of people around them. So I just kind of started with that idea and then just kept growing and growing.
So one of the things that I've heard you say is that as a writer, you develop a very private relationship with your characters.
Right.
So now you started this tour. How does that change when your characters become so public? Do they seem different to you? Were you surprised how people react to them?
They do seem different. I kind of let go of them. You know, they don't. You know, when I'm creating them, when I'm writing my book, they're with me all the time. And not just when I'm sitting at the computer and working. They're with me when I'm, at the school playground waiting for my kids to get out of class, or when I'm, taking my daughter to her piano lesson, or whatever. They're constantly there, and they're present. But when the book is done, I kind of let go. And then they kind of enter this public sphere, this public life, and other people begin to take ownership of them and become kind of proprietary about them, because hopefully they get attached to them and they identify with them. So then I just let go and share it with
And you're okay with that?
Yeah, of course. That's.
I'd be annoyed if I spent all that time writing about those people and now somebody else says something else.
Well, it's the whole point of writing is to write something of deep within yourself and then share it with as many people as you can and have them have some kind of emotional experience based on your thoughts. Otherwise, why even publish a book?
Well, you know, one of the things I have found with each one of your books and this one again, which is the gift, I think, of a brilliant storyteller like you, is you start the book and you want everything in your life to stop so that you can stay with these characters and read the story. And at the beginning of this book, you tell a fable, a folk tale, a fairy tale, where a div, which is a
some kind of big giant
creature, who snaps up children who are in difficult, impoverished situations. You don't know what's going to happen to them, and as it turns out, they are not treated in the way one might think.
Well, I think a lot of the book turns out that way. This story is about, as you mentioned, there's a village that is visited by a creature who demands that the village give it one child, or he's going to take 10. You know, so and he picks one family, and that one family has to give one child, and he picks the family of this old peasant who has a little boy that he, among his five children, he has five children, but he has a little boy that he loves, you know, privately above all. And it turns out that that's the boy he has to give away. And so he dies. And the div takes the boy away. And then the folktale doesn't go where you think it would, because it's kind of turned upside down. And the big div turns out to be, turns out to kind of dispense a complicated lesson about love and loyalty and the responsibility of being a parent to this old peasant, one that he didn't expect and probably didn't want. And I think many of the chapters that follow kind of follow that pattern, in that they kind of don't go where you think they're going to go. And the characters, the revelations that they do find along the way aren't the ones that they thought they were going to get. So the whole book is kind of shaped in that kind of unexpected way.
Well, and I found, we're not going to have any spoilers, because I'm sure hardly any of you could have gotten the book. Have any of you read the book? You couldn't have. It just came out, right? You'll be happy to know I have. And one of the things that, because you see a number of themes, or I saw a number of themes in the book, and one that struck me is this dichotomy of losing your connection and your root, as opposed to the possibility of a better and a different life.
Yeah.
What's that tension like for you as you thought about it in writing the book?
Well, it's not something I thought about consciously. I really was just kind of following the characters and developing the story and just kind of seeing where it was going. And it's only after a while of, you know, after writing a substantial portion of the book that I stepped back and I said, you know, here's a theme that's emerging. I never start with a big idea and then narrow it down into a story that will fit that theme. It's the other way around. I'll begin with a small story that develops into some bigger theme. And then I notice as a secondary effect that this is what this story is turning out to be about. And so that's one of the things that I noticed, as this book really is becoming one of the themes in this book is about losing a part of yourself. Mm. It's about being displaced. It's about being separated from something that felt important and vital to you, something that helped you understand yourself, and somehow that is missing. And I feel like in human experience, it's a very common thing. And all of us in this audience, around the world, life is a process of losing things. You know, we're all in that way kind of connected by things that we've lost. And it may not be material things. It may be memory, or it may be beauty. Mm-hmm. It may be our dignity, or independence, a family member, or a lover, whatever it is. And so we're all connected by that sense. And this book is, each character in this book is sort of has lost something vital, and then either consciously, subconsciously, is trying to reconnect, trying to reunite. So there's this, the book is about the separation and also reunion. And the reunions that do occur in the book, and those who find their closures, those who find those things that they find that it's not quite what they thought it was going to be, and that life kind of has its own plans for you.
And the twin to that, I found, is the dichotomy of how you can view. There's a character in the book, the brother of a brother who, on the one hand, does something that seems despicable, and on the other hand, then goes on to spend his life in a way that seems selfless.
Yeah, you're talking about Nabi.
Nabi.
Yeah.
Would you consider him a good man?
So, to kind of describe who Nabi is, the little boy and the little sister, the little girl, his little sister, they live in an impoverished village in the, a remote part of Afghanistan. And they have a step uncle whose name is Nabi, and who's a driver slash cook for this very wealthy couple in Kabul. And he lives in this big house, kind of mansion-like setting. And every month he comes and visits his family. And Nabi is sort of the agent of this act of rupture or the separation of the children. And there are complicated reasons behind that. But to say whether Nabi is good or bad, I think is difficult to say, because that's one of the things about this book that I think when you guys have a chance to read, you might notice is in that I think the book is still morally instructive in a way, but the lessons are more messy and more complex.
Like life.
Like life, and that's part of the reason why, one of the reasons I really love the Rumi verse that begins the book, which is out beyond the notions of right doing and wrong doing. There's a field, and I'll meet you there. And I think this book kind of is at a remove from the more black and white archetypal notions of good and bad that I think were more pervasive in my earlier books. And it's not really a conscious decision. I think I've sort of changed as a writer over time. And whether for the better or for the worse, that's up to the readers to decide. But certainly for me, I think this is a much more morally ambiguous book. The characters' behaviors, I think, emerge from a place that is more nuanced and more conflicted, and therefore hopefully more interesting.
You know, there was an interesting part. One of the characters, Parry, who is taking care of her...
The little girl.
The little girl, taking care of her father. And she had a...
This is a different... Yeah, okay, I see what
you're saying. Yeah, and she had a line talking about ambiguity where... So this is a young...
One who's taking care of her father.
Takes care of her father, and she looks like this has been an incredibly selfless act. She's given up almost her life to be taking care of her father. And then she says, namely, how afraid I am to be free despite my frequent desire for it, afraid of what will happen to me, what will I do with myself when Baba is gone. All my life I have lived like an aquarium fish in the safety of a glass tank behind a barrier as impenetrable as it has been transparent.
Yeah. So this seemingly extremely dutiful daughter who is taking care of her incapacitated father, by all appearances, seems to be this angelic, selfless person. And
right.
There are elements of that in her, certainly. She loves her father. But at the same time, you know, she has other motivations that are more private, that she really is a frightened person. She says, the truth is, I've always needed the weight of Baba on my back, the weight of my father on my back. And it's part of how she understands herself you know, she is afraid to go out there on her own. She's afraid of failure. She's afraid of falling flat on her face. She's not a fully grown adult yet. And letting go of her father is scary because she'll have to face adulthood. And so she's clinging to her childhood as much as she is to her father. And so it's a more, it's a sort of a more nuanced, a more complex motivation for what she appears to be doing.
And, you know, speaking of that, when your family left Afghanistan, went to Iran and then to Paris.
Right.
What was that time like for you in exile?
Well, really, that wasn't quite exile because the reason we moved is because my father was a diplomat and he was assigned to a post in the Afghan embassy first in Tehran and then in Paris. So we went to those cities with a full understanding that once his term expires in 3 years, we're
going
to go back. And so the second time that we left to go to Paris, you know, we just put some clothes in our suitcases and went to Paris in 76, fully expecting to come back in 1980. And by then, the face of the country had changed. It was in a war had started. It had been invaded by a superpower, and it just our lives were turned upside down.
And then when you emigrated to the United States, to what extent did your father, your mother, or all of you acclimate to California? How difficult was that for your...
Well, it was difficult for us. It was difficult for me, but I think far more difficult for my parents.
Yeah.
Now, myself being in my 40s and understanding what it takes to raise a family... You know, I'm 48 years old. My dad was 41 when he brought a family of nine. Five kids, his mother, my aunt, and my mom from Paris to the United States and single-handedly supported us. To me, that takes a lot of spine. So I have so much respect for him. And yet he was, both of my parents were educated people. College educated, they were professionals, they were sort of the upper crust of Kabul society, they were very well known. My mom taught Farsi and history at a large high school, she eventually became the vice principal. I think for them, the being uprooted and being dropped in a completely foreign environment, having to restart their lives, you know, my dad, it was difficult. My dad, I remember him, he was terribly embarrassed by the idea of being on welfare, which we were for a while, for a short period. And he came home one day, and this is like a scene in The Kite Runner. He came home, he goes, I can't do this anymore. I'm just going to get a job and get us off welfare. And so he did. He took on a bunch of jobs. He eventually became a driving instructor and up in the Bay Area. And his specialty was he would teach physically challenged people how to drive. And so the school had given him this van that had all these levers and pumps and stuff, and he would drive these students up and down the streets of the Bay Area in San Francisco. My mom worked Denny's as a waitress for the graveyard shift, and she struggled quite a bit. And eventually she became studied cosmetology, became a hairdresser, and she worked in the same little hole-in-the-wall salon in East San Jose for a better part of 20 years until she retired. And so it was for them, the adjustment was very stark. It was very dramatic. For me, if I was 15 when I came here, and my adjustment was those of the kind of awkward teenager who suddenly doesn't know how to speak barely a word of English and is in high school, you know, in a freshman, regular English freshman. And I sort of became one of those invisible creatures on campus, one of those, you know, kids that live kind of on the periphery of high school culture and is sort of looking from the outside in. So I never really enjoyed high school very much. It was a kind of an unpleasant experience.
And do you think your parents longed to go back to Afghanistan?
They did initially when there was something at stake there for them, when there were still people that they felt connected to, when there was still family and things that reminded them of their former lives. I do remember after the Taliban fell in 2001, I was sort of getting ready to go to Afghanistan. I'd been dying to go back. And I told my dad, I said, you know, we should go together. Let's you and I go. And he didn't want to. He said, it'll be painful. He So God, I won't remember anybody on the streets. I won't know anybody. I just know the streets and the walls and the buildings, and I don't want to go back for that reason. There's nobody there for me anymore. Mm.
But it was such a change in life for them.
To coming here.
Yeah.
It was dramatic.
And Khalid, when I think about Afghanistan, and I did some reading as I thought about speaking with you. You know, Afghanistan since the early 80s has been through, been the site of so much war, so much disruption, so much violence. And at one point in the book, you have your character refer to 2002 as a moment of optimism in Afghanistan. Could you tell us a little bit about why that felt like a moment of optimism, what it feels like now, and what would you want us to know about Afghanistan and understand about it in 2 seconds?
I remember that time because I actually went to Afghanistan in March of 2003, which is the reason why one of the chapters is set precisely in that month and that year, because I remember that feeling so very well. And I met a lot of people in Kabul, including a lot of people from California, a lot of Afghans who'd gone back to try and, they were visiting or they were working. And there was kind of a very heady atmosphere. There was kind of sort of this intoxicating, optimistic aura that things are finally changing. The wars are over, the Taliban have left, the country is at peace, and now we're rebuilding, and there was this kind of, in some circles at least, kind of this dream of a semi-Jeffersonian style democracy in Afghanistan and so on. And, at that time, there was no insurgency to speak of, really. There were no suicide bombs, no IEDs, and these things didn't develop.
But I think we forget that.
Well, we do forget that. And so there was reason to be optimistic, although the warnings, the writing was on the wall already. The warning signs were there because the day that I landed in Kabul, 2 days later, we went to war against Iraq. And then that really, I think, damaged the campaign in Afghanistan, and everybody in Afghanistan feared it. Feared that it would. And so things didn't go as people really planned. The Afghan state today, 10 years after I went there, is at best a mixed bag. I mean, there's a tremendous sense of dissatisfaction with the government of Afghanistan. Even granted that the job that they had to do was colossal, despite that, I think the people of Afghanistan expected and probably deserved more. There's concerns among Afghan people about the security situation in many parts of the country. There's concern about massive unemployment, and there's concern about rampant, pretty much institutionalized corruption in Afghanistan. And those are crippling problems to the democratic process. And there are no clear-cut answers to how those things will be addressed, how they'll be rectified in the next few years. I happen to have high hopes for Afghanistan, or reasonably high hopes for Afghanistan, in the long term, by the time I think I'm an old man. Although I'm on my way there now, by the time I'm an old man, I think things will be a lot better. I don't know that it'll be a whole lot better in 5 years.
What do you think will fuel that possible outcome far down the road?
Technology. I think it is a tremendously powerful transformative force, and the Afghans will be transformed by it as well. Afghanistan doesn't have the infrastructure to borrow technology from the country, so it will.
It's a good thing.
You know what? Yeah, it is. It's the one time where incompetence is good. So it's inevitable. And what gives me hope is that Afghans are very young people. That you go walk the street of Kabul, everybody's young, impossibly young. The median age in the country is 17. You know, 60% of the country is under the age of 20. And these are people who came of age during the wars. They're sick of it. They're frankly sick of it. They have no appetite for fighting. They have none of the sort of prejudices and ideological doggedness of the generation of the Soviet war. You know, they're part of this modern world, and they want to engage with the West. They want to engage with the outside world. They're interested in things that will produce a civil society. And I think because of their technology, because Afghanistan is increasingly connected, increasingly through the airwaves, through the web, information is going to come in, new ways of thinking. And that's the only way Afghanistan is going to change, is by just a organic, natural change from within. It can't be imposed by the U.S. And people say, well, what should we do in Afghanistan? So you got to let the Afghans figure it out. You know, you won't be able to make the Afghans respect women. It's just not going to happen. It has to happen from within. And it will, but it will take a long time.
Yeah, and I guess the worry, the counter-argument would be that where there's economic poverty, that the Taliban will look like the ones who can provide the economic stability. Is that a reasonable...
The Taliban were never seen as any kind of economic...
Engine
whatsoever. And repeatedly over the last 10 years, polls have been done in Afghanistan. There is no popular support for the Taliban. Nationally, it's under 10%. If you go to the Taliban heartland, and even in the deeply tribal, conservative, hardcore Pashtun regions, it's under 30%. So nationally, there's no appetite for the Taliban. The only thing the Taliban brought that people supported was the fact that outside of the hardcore Pashtunists, the only thing they brought was peace. And they did bring it. And because what preceded the Taliban was the four darkest years of the last 30 in Afghanistan, which is the doomsday scenario now. This is what Afghans fear, that once NATO and the U.S. pull back in 2014, we're going to go back to 1992 through 1996. And we're going to have militia warfare. All these militias that are armed to the teeth, that are now part of the political parties, will become militias again, and the old animosities will flare up once more. The old lines of tension will pit people against each other, and once again the civilians will be caught in the middle of a all-out ethnic civil war.
Yeah.
And once again you'll have it. So that's a doomsday scenario.
We're not going there though, right?
Well, you know, there are many Afghans who believe we are. And with some reasonably justifiable argument. I mean, it's not a fait accompli that we're not going there. We could. For instance, if the elections are a disaster next year, you know, and if the perception that the elections are, you know, just wrought with massive fraud, if the elections are violent and there's no sense of legitimacy to the government that takes over from Mr. Karzai, you could see how divisiveness could disintegrate into violence and instability. So that's a critical period right there. So anyway, that's the Taliban sort of rescued the country from that militia war, because the militias were so fractured. The Taliban were a united group, unlike now, which, you know, is a whole other issue now. But back then, they were a unified group that came in and could easily take over the country with the help of the generosity of the Pakistani government, and a twinkle in their eye, of course. But it's the only thing that they brought is the rockets stopped flying.
Interesting. So speaking of generosity, there's a poem that I found. One of the things that I had the pleasure of doing after reading the impact that Afghan poetry had on you was I read a number of Persian poets, and one was, I know I'm going to kill the name, Sa'di?
Sa'di, yeah.
And the poem that he wrote is, "All Adam's race are members of one frame. since all at first from the same essence came, when by hard fortune one limb is oppressed, the other members lose their wonted rest. If thou feelest not for others' misery, a son of Adam is no name for thee. So your novels have educated millions and millions of us about the plight of the Afghans. Tell us about how you established your foundation that gives life to the responsibility defined in this poem.
Well, it's very kind of you to say that my novels have educated. I should make sure I clarify that I don't see myself as an educator at all. I mean, my intention is to write a compelling story. That's really what drives me. If I actually had the notion that I'm writing these books because I want to educate people, I would probably just be a horrible writer, and I wouldn't write any books, and I would just as soon go back to medicine. You know, I write because I love the craft of the creative process and so on. Now, novels have a life outside of what writers intend for them to be. And so, yes, in that regard, the people who read my books have seen a different face of Afghanistan, and so in some sense, they've taken something away from those books with regards to Afghan life, Afghan culture, and so on. But it has not been my intention to teach people. But I just wanted to clarify that, because sometimes, you know, there's a moniker that I want to make sure that it's not mine. But
and you know, before we get to the foundation, but the thing that I think does happen that is so brilliant about your books is, so these stories are often set in Afghanistan, but here's the way I think we become educated. It is very easy for Americans to think that Afghans or Iraqis or somebody else are somehow wired differently than we as Americans, that losing their children is somehow less painful because so many children die. And so I think one of the most important things I think that we can gain in reading, fiction or nonfiction, is an understanding of other people. Oh. And so I think in that way, when you read your new book, this could be anywhere, these conflicts, these dilemmas, these ambiguities. And so in that way, I think you're an astounding educator.
Oh, no, you're very kind to say. And I don't argue that there is a very instructive element to reading fiction. In fact, that's one of the reasons I read fiction. My point is that if the fiction writer goes into it with the mindset of an educator, he's bound or she is bound to produce a terrible work of art.
Yeah.
That has to come as a natural by-process. You really have to just
focus. So far, so good.
Well, then, thank you. But we understand
anyway,
each other.
Anyway, I would...
No, I started the foundation... Well, I answer the question this way, by making a reference to this book. There's a chapter in this book where there's a young physician who lives in the Bay Area and who is very successful.
Huh. Go figure.
I know. I could have at least made him a lawyer or something. And he goes to Afghanistan and has a very... strange experience, in that he goes, and when he gets there, he feels like he's at home, and he also feels like he's a complete outsider, and he is bowled over by an overwhelming sense of guilt, because he sees how he lives. His kids get to go to school, they get guitar lessons, they have video games, and he walks the streets of Kabul, and it's just hordes of boys who are beggars, who have no shoes. And so he feels terribly guilty, because he feels like partly he doesn't really belong here anymore. This, you know, he struggles with whether this is his home or not. He doesn't know what to do with this feeling. His response to that feeling when he comes back home to America is to sort of to have a sort of a contemptuous stance with regards to his own privilege, with his own life. And he begins to see his kids in a different light. And then, of course, it goes somewhere else, because the story doesn't go where you think it's going to go. But that aspect of it, at least the first part of it, him going there and this being, having been struck by this wave of guilt, is what I felt the first time I went there, maybe the second time, although I've gotten better at it since then. But because I just felt terrible, because I felt like I'm not better than these people, I'm just luckier than them. And so I felt like some of what I had achieved in life was not entirely earned. So the foundation was one way to address this icky, unpleasant feeling inside of me and to turn it outwards into something more positive and to address the source of the things that were causing this feeling to begin with. That's partly why. But also because my books have been widely read now, and one of the things that has given me a public forum, kind of a platform, for me to speak about things that I care about a lot. Now, I came to this country as an asylum seeker. I would never have the bad taste to compare my conditions with those of Afghan refugees, even though we were also displaced and uprooted and so on and so forth. But the plight of those refugees who lost their homes and fled to Pakistan and Iran and watched the country unravel from there, it was always close to my heart. And so the bulk of what we've done with the foundation after I went to Afghanistan and had the chance to visit with refugees is to try to help those refugees who've come back to Afghanistan. I've gone there a number of times, met these families. You saw in the video what I saw. And so our foundation, one of the things that we do is to try to help those returning refugees who've come back and try to help them get back on their feet, largely by providing them with shelter and building them a home.
Yeah, it's so basic.
It's a basic thing. If you don't have a home, any place that you call home is, you know, roof over your head, it's very difficult to think about, you know, education. You know, you need a home.
Yeah. Well, we could sit here talking a long time, but I want to give some folks an opportunity to ask some questions. So there are mics down here. I can't see. The mics are right there. So we can take a few minutes of questions. If you come to the mic, go right ahead.
Ready? I have Fred, a Thousand Splendid Sons, and Kite Runner. And it's very humanistic stories. But I want to know how you got such an insightful female point of view in A Thousand Splendid Sons.
Well, thank you for thinking that I did achieve that. And I struggled with it for a long time. And I remember my beloved and late agent, Elaine Koster, who died in 2010 and to whom this book is also dedicated. I remember calling her after she kept prodding me about, kind of in her own inimitable, subtle way, you know, what my second book was going to be about. Did you ever know Elaine?
Mm-hmm.
She's an amazing woman. So I finally said, Elaine, are you asking me what the book's about? She goes, yes. So I said, okay. Well, it's about an Afghan woman who has this terrible... No, actually, it's about two women, and I'm going to divvy up the book in, like, several parts. And one part is going to be her perspective, and the second part is going to be the other woman's perspective. And I'm, like, talking, and Elaine's not saying anything. And I just kind of stop. And she goes, well, you know, it's really tough for male authors to, like, you know, write about women. You got to be careful. And I remember that with some sense of hubris, I said, I think it'll be fine, you know. And then I ran straight into this wall. And I was like, oh, my gosh, she was right. Because I was so conscious, hyper-conscious all the time with every word that... Oh, would a woman do that? Or, you know, would she do that? And I found myself doing ridiculous things, like going to my wife and say, so what, how would a woman respond to this? As if, you know, my wife grew up in a burqa, you know, in a village or something. She was raised in Bethesda, you know. So, you know, eventually I just gave up. It almost became kind of a crippling thing. I almost, like, gave up on the book because it was so horrible. The writing was terrible. And so, and then I just gave up on it and said, you know, I'll just think of these two women as human beings, you know, as people. And forget about the gender, forget about trying to understand the emotional arena occupied by a woman, you know, because I'll never get it. So And just think about the core, the essence of the character, the things that motivate them, the things that frighten them, the things that make them hopeful, and so on. And magically, you know, at least in my perception, the characters came to life and began dictating their own fate and began taking on their own persona. And I no longer was the ventriloquist pulling the strings, you know, it was the other way around.
I have one more short question. Are your books welcomed and admired in Afghanistan?
I think by many, but I can't say universally, because if you're living in exile for a long time, as I have, and you decide to write occasionally politically charged novels about your homeland, the people who actually live there, you can imagine that they will have opinions. Some of those opinions have been ones of support, in fact, many. Largely because many people feel that they may not agree with everything my books say. Not that they don't agree with the things my books say, but they don't agree with the airing out of the things that my books say. That's more accurate. That despite that, that it does bring to light the challenges and the hardships that Afghan people have faced, and it does make that public in a kind of an artistic way, and it does change the conversation about Afghanistan in some circles, at least, that there's something positive to talk about. Largely, that's been the reaction. But there are, I think, the older generation, the more conservative religious generations, have their reservations about my book, both the previous and especially the first one, because it touches on issues that are considered very sensitive, charged, taboo in Afghanistan. But the younger, urbanized, educated, professional Afghans, my take is that they're much more supportive.
Very good, thank you. Just wanted to say one final thing, that my 1,000 Splendid Sons is on my iPod, and a chapter will pop up every once in a while in the midst of my songs.
Oh.
And it brings me right back to the story.
Well,
so thank
accident.
You very much.
Thank you, man.
Yes.
Salam. Hali shoma chotore?
Shoma khub hastin.
Man Nazi hastam az Iranam. Ye sual daram. I have a question. Is it a religion? Islamic religion or culture?
Oh, no. Is it your intent to get
me in
trouble?
Is it make the woman down, or is the man made this religion for their own benefit?
Well,
I don't know her.
Is it man-made religion?
No, I got you. Look, I think people find in Scripture what they want to find. I think people have a preset mind, preconceived mindset, and then they go searching in the Scripture to support their behavior. And if you look hard enough and you want to interpret as loosely as you like, you will find what you want to find. In Afghanistan, women, the situation for women has been going on for a long, long time. And it has far more to do with a kind of tribal tradition, with the ideas having to do with honor and family name and so on and so forth, than really with Scripture, the Quran, and Islam. So I happen to think that the problems that women face in Afghanistan has its roots really in Afghan tribal culture, particularly in those conservative tribal regions in Afghanistan. And that's why I do think that that situation will continue until there's a paradigm shift, until there's a cultural shift in Afghanistan, until, you know, we're able to, the young Afghans are able to kind of transform that organically. And that will happen with time, but I think it will take time.
I hope so. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
I wanted to, you know, someone gave me the Kite Runner.
Could you come a little closer to the mic?
Oh, I'm sorry. Someone gave me the Kite Runner, and I devoured it. And I got I mean, almost to the end of the book, and then I went, and I was struck by the power and the beauty of the language, not only the characters in the story, but the language that you used. And I went, English isn't his first language. And I thought about the relationship that you have with English and mm-hmm. how vividly you use it and how expressively. And it, as someone you were talking about sort of standing outside of, and it's not your home language.
Oh, I understand,
and,
yeah.
And it's almost, I don't know, I guess I'm going to ask for your thoughts on it.
Well, thank you. English is actually my third language, because the second language I learned was French, which I spoke for years, and then I picked up English when I came to the States. But I picked up English very quickly. And without trying to toot my horn, that I've had a lifelong kind of affinity for languages, a love of languages, and also kind of an affinity for it. That is one thing. Second is I was 15, which is still a fairly tender age, at which you haven't become fossilized yet, and so you're able to absorb new information, and you're still able to learn new tricks. And so, you know, I was very, you know, young, and so picked up English. But I don't think it's my knowing English that's allowed me to be a writer. There is a voice in my head and a kind of a inborn instinct to create things. And I was writing stories in Kabul in Farsi, you know, and I noticed that my stories always produce a certain kind of effect on people around me. And I wrote stories in French when I was in France, and I noticed the same thing, that if I shared my story with anybody, it had an effect. And so then I, you know, now for me, it's very natural to write in English. You know, I mean, I read and write Farsi, but I no longer have kind of that narrative voice in my head for Farsi. And I could maybe write a short story, but I feel very much at home writing in English now. There's a cadence, a rhythm, a tempo that has now become my own, and I rely on it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes.
First of all, I'd like to commend you on taking what you have done with your gifts and making the world a better place, especially hopefully for our children if they manage
Thank
to
you.
Get through climate warming, etc. We are fortunate to having very interesting people in our lives, and some of them are writers whose books have been turned into movies, and the results are not always very fulfilling, in quotes, for the authors. And I'm wondering what your experience has been having your book translated. Books? I'm not sure. I think both of them were made into movies.
No, one.
Okay, Kite Runner. What was it like for you? What was your involvement in that?
Well, it was fun.
And were you happy with it?
I'm sorry?
Were you happy with what they did with it?
Well, you know, I thought it was a good movie. Was it a great movie? I don't know. But I thought it was a good movie in that many of the core elements of the novel, the emotional elements of the novel, were there. And I thought, in some sense, the movie was kind of important in one way, because Hollywood has a kind of a troubled history depicting that region of the world. It tends to treat that region in a very kind of predictable, stereotypical ways. In other words, if there's a Muslim guy in the story, he's kind of like Chekhov's gun. He's going to do something crazy. Or he's there because he's Muslim, you know. He's not just there. But in the movie, you had an entire cast of
right.
these characters whose faith happened to be incidental entirely to the story. It was really just kind of this very normal human story about a boy and his dad and his friend and kind of these things. And it was just had nothing to do. The point of entry into the story was not political violence. It was not terrorism. And I think that was a welcome change than business as usual. My involvement with it was fairly peripheral, although I did go to China with my dad for 2 weeks to just hang out on the set and kind of serve as a occasional sideline consultant. And that was fun to see how the movie was put together. And I actually happened to be there for the big kite fighting scene, which took like 4 days to shoot, and they had to get up at 3 a.m. to cover the entire 3 city blocks with artificial snow. It was this gruff guy from Australia who was a snowman, and he kind of flew in like John Wayne. I mean, he just spread snow everywhere, and everybody was kind of afraid of him. And he, you know, and then there was like chaos, you know. And me and my dad are kind of standing there. It was just like really, it was very difficult to kind of orchestrate the whole scenery because there were so many moving parts. And I remember the second assistant director or something, and he was this young guy who was aging very quickly, you know, and he was constantly smoking. He was kind of stooped over like this, and he always looked very upset. And he was walking by, and he was kind of murmuring to himself, like, "Who wrote this scene?" You know, what he said wasn't entirely Christian, but you get the point, you know. And I kind of like receded in the back. And so it was kind of fun, but, you know, I like movies. I really do. I'm kind of a lifelong amateur cinephile, so I don't have kind of a condescending stance towards film.
Like it corrupting a book.
No, I don't. Never understood how a movie corrupts a book. Does it actually change the words on the pages in the bookstore? No, the book is there. So if you know, if you saw the movie, well, that's a bad movie. Oh, the book. The book is very good. So there you go. So I don't understand how it corrupts it. It's you have your own vision of the book. That's never going to change because of a bad movie.
Yeah. So. Thank you. Yes.
Hi, Dr. Hamid. I just wanted to tell you, I didn't expect you to be so young. I have a daughter of your age.
It's actually so
you heard
annoying.
When I said my age, right? So.
And I really wish you all the luck with your global, you know, fame and accolade and all the things you are achieving at such an age. I really, really admire and congratulate you, your parents and family. And I wanted to just touch upon, like you mentioned about your, like, some of your novels, like Splendid Thousand Suns, like Airing the Dirty Linen.
Yeah.
I have seen young contemporary authors, whether it's a Jhumpa Lahiri from India, Hossein Hamid from Pakistan, or Orhan Pamuk from Turkey. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like, or even American Jonathan Franzen in Corrections and Freedom. I have read all these, and it makes you feel like you want to belong to that part where you came from, or where your parents or grandparents, my great-grandparents were from Afghanistan and settled in Frontier and then came to India and ended up now me, fourth generation in America, and fifth, my grandchildren are here now. So I just wanted to say that makes you probably feel, it's not dirty, airing the dirty linen, it's just wanting to know the real past, your family, your roots, I would say. And that's what I see in young authors, contemporary, no matter which country they have come from, and what I see in your novel. And when I read this, Splendid, it reminded me of my grandmother, the way she lived, all the people in that village, sometimes the wives were treated or families.
Yeah.
And it just brought back that. And that's what probably, and it was amazing how you also able to bring that into that.
Thank
as
you.
A woman, I understood. As a young girl, I saw that. But I know it was amazing how you mentioned how you came to that.
That's very kind. I appreciate it. And, you know, and the people who say you're airing dirty laundry, you know, if you kind of follow their advice, you know, and their vision for what fiction should look like, you know, essentially it turns out to be like propaganda.
Yeah.
You know, you're writing about this very happy place with a very fierce, proud, happy people doing wonderful things. And there's nobody's ever mistreated and everything is just fine.
So where's the story?
Where's the story? And more importantly, the point of fiction is to actually talk about things that make us uncomfortable, to about those divisive lines in our lives that create dialogue and debate and make us think about things in a new way. And the things that were in The Kite Runner have never been said publicly, ever, in Afghan history.
Right.
So it was a real, real shock for a lot of people to read that book. And for some of them, it was a very difficult experience. And for others, they were like, ah,
liberated.
About time. You know, somebody said it, you know. So that was a reaction that I expected.
Yeah, and I think it and I think it needs to be. I mean, I do think of the conversations that have taken place over the years since Kite Runner came out, and I think we'll continue with this book. That's how things happen. This is why fiction has the important role that it has, and I think you're right. What I think is interesting in what you're saying is the having the conversation by a young person about a culture that feels steeped in another time.
Yeah.
That matters. So I think what we're going to have to do, because we are coming to a close, so how about if we take two more questions, and we'll go to this mic, then that mic, and if they could be questions.
Well.
Thank you.
I have a brief statement, confession, then question.
We have people
statement.
With questions.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, God bless you. Thank you.
Brief confession. I haven't actually read any of your work. However, my wife, who's an English teacher, has read all of it, and I am so looking forward to learning more about your life and the stories you've shared. Simple question. What's your favorite book?
Well, first of all, thank you for your preemptive thanks. I don't have a favorite book. I can't answer that question. I really don't. This is something that people have asked me for 10 years, and my wife is always like, just have an answer. I don't. But if I had to, if you really forced me into it, I would pick the Shahnameh, which is the Book of Kings, and it's a masterpiece. It's the crowning jewel of Persian literature, really. And it's written by Ferdowsi 1,000 years ago, and it's 1,000 pages long, and it's sort of the Persian version of the Iliad, let's say.
You get a copy when you get Halid's book.
There's a beautiful penguin.
There is.
Penguin has a phenomenal translation of it by Dr. Davis, and it's a beautiful, beautiful story. It's amazing. So that's the book that I grew up reading when I was a boy. It's still my favorite.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, you're the last question.
Well, this is pressure.
It's a big job.
Well, this is a question that's coming from my students. I'm a 10th grade global history teacher in New York City. Your book, 1,000 Splendid Sons, is required reading for my class, optional reading for my class. They get out of another assignment if they do that. So most of them do it. It's a nice little trick, but it works. And we have book discussions that are compelling, that are interesting, and that takes my kids, and I see a whole different side of them through these discussions. And the question, so tomorrow is our last discussion on 1,000 Splendid Sons. I've been doing this for about 3 years, and every year they ask the same question of me, so I'm asking of you.
Okay.
So when they ask tomorrow, I'll say, well, this is what the author said.
How cool will you be?
Yes.
I'll bet your answer will be better than mine.
Unless you want to come to my school tomorrow and talk to my kids. But why does Miriam have to die at the end of 1,000 Splendid Sons?
Oh.
Oh, I hope it's not a spoiler. I thought everyone would read it. Sorry.
And there you have it.
Sorry.
We only promised there wouldn't be a spoiler for the new book.
That's how I
Yeah.
Heard. You should have done it.
That's true. That's true. So. And as I always say, if it was a spoiler for you, you probably just deserve it. You know, you should have read it by now.
That's right.
Oh, well.
If they had been in my
it's
class.
Not, I never know where my books are going. I never have any idea what the book's going to be about, really, even. Or how it's, let alone how it's going to end. I sit down with a kind of a very vague idea of what's going to happen that day, and inevitably what happens that day is very different from what I thought was going to happen. I knew as I began to really write a substantial amount of the book that it was going to have kind of this bittersweet ending, and that a price had to be paid by one of these women, and I wasn't sure which one. And then that lady asked about the characters, and suddenly the characters became alive. And one of the things that happened once the characters just kind of became clear to me was that the only way the book could end was with this act of self-sacrifice by the older one. That's the only way it could end. I couldn't conceive of another way of it ending. I could write a different ending, but it would be one that to me would lack any kind of cathartic truth. It would shortchange everything that happened before. And I felt to me was the only truthful way to end the book.
Okay. Thank you.
And you wouldn't have liked the book as much if I...
Whenever my kids rewrite it, she stays alive.
Thank you. So, in closing, I have a couple of thoughts and predictions. I think the success that your two previous books have enjoyed will pale in comparison to what I think your new book deserves.
Wow. Thank you. Strong words.
Well, you know, I was struck when I started the book, and I think I said that earlier, that there is an authenticity, there is an understanding that you think about when you read your books. There's I think I brought it with me. There's a quote by Italo Calvino that says that classic books exercise a particular influence both when they imprint themselves on our imagination as unforgettable and when they hide in the layers of memory disguised as the individual's unconscious. Wow. And I find with your books, the images, the conversations come back to me years later. They stay with you. And one of the most well-known of Persian folktales, 1001 Nights, is a medieval folktale collection which tells the story of Scheherazade, a queen who must relate a series of stories to her malevolent husband, the king, to delay her execution. The stories are told over a period of 1001 nights, and every night she ends the story with a suspenseful situation, forcing the king to keep her alive for another day. Your stories keep us alive. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much. That was lovely. Thank you.